I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. There have been many movies made about Wyatt Earp, starring a wide array of leading men, Kevin Costner, James Garner, Burt Lancaster, James Stewart, to name just a few. Here's a scene from the 1946 film My Darling Clementine, starring Henry Fonda as Wyatt Earp and Victor Mature as Doc Holliday. Earp is a new marshal trying to get a decent poker hand when gambler Doc Holliday arrives.
Howdy. Good evening. I'm Wyatt Earp. I know. I know all about you and your reason for being here.
But I heard a lot about you too, Doc. You left your mark around in Deadwood, Denver, and places. Fact, a man could almost follow your trail going from graveyard to graveyard.
There's one here too. The biggest graveyard west of the Rockies. Marshals and I usually get along much better when, we understand that right away.
Get your meaning, Doc.
Good. Have a drink?
Thanks, believe I will.
Mac, a glass of champagne for the marshal.
Make it whiskey.
Our guest, historian Andrew Eisenberg, says that much of what we know about Wyatt Earp from Hollywood has been exaggerated or is patently false. He writes in his new book, Wyatt Earp, A Vigilante Life, that Earp was as much con man as lawman. He traces his early years in the Midwest to Wichita, to Dodge City, to Tombstone, site of the shootout at the OK Corral, to California, where he died in 1929 at the age of 80. Andrew Eisenberg is a professor of history at Temple University. His research and teaching includes environmental history, the history of the American West, and the history of encounters between settlers and natives in North America. And Andrew Eisenberg, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here, I have to say. I've been an admirer of yours and this program for a long time, so it's a real honor.
I thank you for that. So should we forget everything we've seen on TV and in the movies when it comes to Wyatt Earp and start with a blank slate?
It might be better to start with a blank slate. Much of what we know about Earp from Hollywood is not the way things really were. He was not a man who was committed to the law 100%. In fact, he spent a lot of time on the other side of the law.
And I don't want to jump ahead, but in part what's interesting about your book and about his story are the kind of contacts, I guess, that he had in the early days of Hollywood and how some biographers and people sort of worked with Wyatt Earp to create this myth of this man.
In the last couple decades of his life, beginning around 1900 or so, Wyatt Earp, for a lot of reasons, he had some negative celebrity. People knew him, but they knew him in only negative ways. And so he really set out to remake his reputation. And he wanted to be remembered the way he wanted to be remembered. And he found himself in Los Angeles, and he started hanging out at Hollywood Studios. And he met with Raoul Walsh and Alan Dwan and Charlie Chaplin, and he charmed Charlie Chaplin with stories about the Old West. And he particularly befriended a couple of the biggest silent film Western stars of the period, William S. Hart and Tom Mix. And he really became a friend of Hart, and he wanted Hart to play him on screen. And Hart convinced him that what he needed to do was to write a memoir, and then that memoir could be the basis of a film adaptation. So the thing is, Wyatt Earp took a really active role in creating the Hollywood Wyatt Earp character.
But what's interesting, reading your book and also reading about Wyatt Earp, is that he's much more interesting and certainly much more complicated than this Hollywood Wyatt Earp that we've come to know and I think in many ways come to admire.
Certainly that we've come to admire, that he created a kind of wooden persona of the man who's completely committed to justice. Even to the point of having to go outside the law to enforce justice. But anybody in real life would have to be more complicated than that kind of two-dimensional person.
But would you say he was unusual in his both being on the side of the law and then outside of the law, depending on what city he was in or what period of his life he was in?
This actually was not that unusual. He made his living for most of his life as a gambler. He dealt a game called Faro, which was a very popular game in the 19th century West. And a lot of the gamblers with whom he was friends and who worked in a kind of fraternity of gamblers, they would work together against other groups of gamblers as well and try to control certain kinds of territories. it was very useful for some of them to have a badge as well. So he was not the only professional gambler who from time to time would hold a badge. It was a way to have a certain amount of extra authority in the town.
And he was a deputy marshal and deputy sheriff. I mean, he did hold these positions at times in his life.
He did hold these positions, but it's very important that you added at times in his life. I was thinking about this recently, and I added up the periods of time that he spent wearing a badge. And it comes to about five, maybe 5.5 years out of his life, and for never more than a year or so at a time. Even when he was in Dodge City for about 4 years, he would wear the badge during the cattle drive season and then resign his position, head south into Texas, and spend the winter dealing cards, and then come back to Dodge City in the summer.
And how different is faro from poker that I think we do associate with the West and with Wyatt Earp himself?
Very different from poker. Faro is much more like 21 blackjack or three-card Monty. It actually has much more of an association with three-card Monty. The thing about faro is, without getting into the deep weeds of how the game is played, the odds are very even between the dealer and the players. And so the only way a professional faro dealer could make a living at this was to cheat, was to palm cards, was to make sure the cards came up in the order that would be beneficial to the dealer. And everybody in the 19th century knew this. Even the people who sat at a faro table and played the game knew that the dealer was trying to cheat them, and that was part of the attraction, that they would try to outsmart or out-cheat the dealer. So it was that was the kind of world of gambling in which Wyatt Earp was enmeshed.
Well, I'm always interested in where people come from, and you do write about his family. He was born in Illinois. His father, Nicholas, I'll let you describe him. I was going to say, you know, a troubled character himself, it seems.
He was a difficult and complicated person himself. He was clearly very restless. He volunteered to serve in the Mexican War around the time that Wyatt Earp was born. He came back from the Mexican War without serving out his term of enlistment. He picked up the family and moved them to Iowa and then back to Illinois and then back to Iowa and then out to California. He tries a number of different jobs. He runs for public office. He's elected a town constable. While he is a town constable in Monmouth, Illinois, which was a dry town, he starts out as a bootlegger. And he's selling whiskey on the side, even though he's supposed to be enforcing the town laws against this. He was a deadbeat. He tended to run out on his debts a lot. And he told a lot of outlandish stories about his own life. He claimed that he had fought in the Black Hawk War when he was nowhere near that war at the time. He claimed to have scouted for Daniel Boone. And Daniel Boone died when Nicholas Earp was 7 years old. So he...
Tall tales.
Tall tales and a kind of restlessness and moving around. And these are traits that Wyatt Earp also had.
I got the feeling, too, that he could be brutal and violent with his family or with... There was a streak of that?
There was a streak of that. That would not be unusual for the 19th century West. Though I don't think that we can think of Nicholas Earp as a kind of stern patriarch who inspired a lot of terror in his sons. I think of him more as a kind of blustery character more than anything else.
And how would you describe Wyatt Earp's personality? I mean, he seemed, from the photographs, he's a very handsome man, and it seems like other people would remark at what a good-looking man he was.
That's absolutely right. Everybody always remarked
and
on
tall,
him.
Too, right?
Yes. He and his brothers were all about 6 feet tall, which was not typical in the middle of the 19th century, so they were all big guys. They all, apparently, according to the testimony, were good-looking, and people tended to mix them up when they were all together in the same place. How to describe Wyatt Earp early on? His family didn't give him a lot of advantages. They were not very well-off, migrant, rural family. And all the sons left their father's household at the earliest opportunity.
Teens?
Exactly. Wyatt's older brothers volunteered to serve in the Union Army. Wyatt wasn't old enough to do that, but he left home when he was 17, 18 years old. There was not a lot holding them there. I think that it was not... It was not the kind of idyllic agrarian upbringing that we tend to romanticize in the 19th century past.
And it seems he was a man of few words. Would that be fair to say?
You know,
from
that,
what you've been able to figure out?
I'm not convinced of that.
Really?
That's the Hollywood image That is the way Henry Fonda, in that clip you played at the top of this program, and the way Burt Lancaster played him, as a man of few words, stoic, taciturn, did not want to talk about himself, did not want to discuss the past. If you look at him clearly at the end of his life, he had no hesitation to talk about himself or talk about the past and have it remembered the way he wanted. He dictated his memoirs over and over again to several different writers. He talked to different Hollywood stars, tried to get them to make a movie about him. So I'm not sure that that part holds up. And when I've read the accounts of him and the descriptions of him by the people who knew him at the time, they say he was courageous, and they say that he struck a kind of commanding figure. And a lot of them remark on what a cool character he was in terms of holding his own and at the gambling table. But taciturn is not in there.
Interesting. He did marry early on a woman named Eurilla Sutherland,
yes.
And she died, what, about a year or so after they married?
Less
than a year after they married, and it seemed like he just went berserk after she died.
It looks like he went off the rails at that point, because within a couple of months, he's arrested in what is now the state of Oklahoma, what was then Indian Territory, for horse theft, and that would have meant about 5 years in a federal penitentiary, but he escapes from jail along with some other people. And then he makes his way to Peoria, Illinois, where one of his older brothers was, and he finds work as an enforcer in a brothel. And he's arrested there three times.
Well, and I think it's interesting that he did kind of lose his way after his wife died. And I don't know, what does that tell us about their relationship or how much he might have loved her? Do we know that, or is that
kind of a
mystery?
We don't know that. And I have to say, one of the frustrations for me as I was researching and writing this book is I wanted letters from Earp, even a handful of letters from Earp to his family members, or letters from his family members to him from this period. There must have been some correspondence because the family was far-flung, but they tended to recongregate in places.
Yeah.
And we just don't have that. So we have to infer as best we can, and the record is really silent about his first wife and what was going through his mind after she died.
And we're almost up in a break here, but I mean, there were many women in Wyatt Earp's life.
Yes.
Can we say that?
Yes, we can. There were the prostitutes, and some of the prostitutes claimed to be, or at least one claimed to be, his wife. He had two later on what were called common law wives. They didn't have an actual marriage certificate, but for all intents and purposes, they were married.
And the last woman he was with, they lived with each other for decades.
Yes. His last wife, they were together by, say, 1885, and she outlived him by a decade and a half.
Well, we are talking about Wyatt Earp, and our guest is Andrew Eisenberg. He's a historian at Temple University. His new book is called Simply Wyatt Earp, and it's subtitled A Vigilante Life. And our guest is saying that the Hollywood version of Wyatt Earp is full of falsehoods and exaggerations. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY Westchester University Graduate Studies, offering over 70 graduate degree and certificate programs in arts and sciences, business, the arts, education, and health sciences. For more information or to submit an application online, wcupa.edu/grad. Westchester University. Learn more. Westchester University proudly supports WHYY.
For some folks, the 4th of July means fireworks, but for garlic growers, it heralds harvest time. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll look at the many ways you can preserve those tasty cloves. Plus, living in a rambunctious garden and answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Mary Roach's book, Gulp, takes readers on a tour of the human digestive system. It's a system that does its job and does it well.
Chewing stimulates saliva. And what I love is that you could put a sock in your mouth and start to chew on it. And your body will go like, okay, boss, I guess you want to eat a sock. I'm here to help you. I'm going to moisten that sock. I'm here for you.
Mary Roach on the next Bullseye from NPR.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Andrew Eisenberg, and he says much of what we believe about Wyatt Earp is not true, and a lot of that fantasy and mythology has come from Hollywood, and I want to play another clip from another Wyatt Earp movie. This is The Gunfight at the O.K. Corral, 1957, and lawman Wyatt Earp is portrayed by Burt Lancaster with Kirk Douglas filling the boots of outlaw Doc Holliday.
You don't owe me a thing. I've never needed anybody in my life, and I sure don't need Doc Holliday.
You're pretty positive about that.
As far as I'm concerned, you can get on your horse and keep riding.
No, thanks. I think I'll stay. You know, Wyatt, you and I are pretty much alike, actually. Both of us live with a gun. The only difference is that badge. What's the matter, preacher? Don't you like being preached at?
Shut up and go to sleep.
And some faint laughter there. I love those accents.
Yeah.
Sounds like a Brooklyn accent.
There was one thing that was said in that dialogue that actually comes close to the truth, where Kirk Douglas says to the Wyatt Earp character, we're a lot alike. In fact, Doc Holliday and Wyatt Earp had a lot of things in common. Both of them had been raised in families that had started out sort of devoutly Methodist, but they had fallen away from that. But both of these men knew how to present themselves to polite society in a way to be accepted. Both of them had become professional gamblers by the 1870s, though the Hollywood version of Earp tends to obscure that. Both of them were capable of impulsive violence. Mm. We tend to put that on the Holliday character and take it off of her, but both of them really were capable of it.
Well, and interestingly, Doc Holliday got his, I don't know if he had a medical degree exactly, but he studied in Philadelphia, right?
He had a dental degree.
A dental degree.
Yes, from a Philadelphia dental college that is now out of business.
And do we know how he contracted TB? He had TB, yes? Or
he
is there any
did.
Question about that?
No, he had tuberculosis, absolutely, which people did not know was something you contracted by breathing in this bacteria. They thought it was a congenital disease. Yeah. They thought it was inherited. So his mother had died of the disease, so they thought, well, that's why.
So how should we understand the relationship between Doc Holliday and Wyatt Earp?
They were extraordinarily close friends, let's put it that way. They were extraordinarily close friends, so close that another gambler slash lawman who knew them both at the time, a guy named Bat Masterson, used a term to describe them that in the 19th century would have implied that they were sort of even closer than that. He invoked a pair of friends from Greek antiquity, Damon and Pythias, which was it meant in 19th century and early 20th century ears, men who he wasn't saying they were a romantic pair, but he's saying they're extremely close friends. In fact, loved one another.
And loved one another, yeah. Which, I mean, that's a lovely thing, isn't it?
Well, no, absolutely. And Wyatt Earp lived in a world of men, right? In these cow towns, in the mining camps of Tombstone and the other mining camps he inhabited later on, men are outnumbering women by an extraordinary amount, which is one reason why there's a demand for the services of prostitutes in these places. That's something that actually Hollywood tends to notice, and in fact, they're not wrong about that. So Wyatt Earp was competing with other men at the gambling table, and he's competing with them for kind of physical dominance and fist fights. But he's also finding his closest friendships with other men.
Interesting. You described these were known as Hell on Wheels towns.
Yes, the AMC program now.
Right, which I don't know how much of that is true or not true, but nonetheless, the Union Pacific Railroad is building its railroad across the country, and then these towns spring up, and you've got gambling, you've got prostitution, you've got drinking, I'm assuming, a lot of men, as you say, competing and probably getting into fights with each other.
Yes. All that is.
This is the Wild West. That
well, it's the Wild West. It's less violent than Hollywood makes it out to be. There will be a year in a cattle trading season in a town like Dodge City where three people will be killed, and that makes Dodge City statistically the most violent city in America. And then the next year, say, no one will be killed, which makes it statistically the safest. So these places existed only for a very short period of time, and it's really kind of hard to tell what was really going on there because the sample is not large enough. But young men, access to firearms, a lot of drinking, boredom, impulsive violence.
Fist fights? I mean,
fist fights as well.
Maybe that
absolutely
was
much more common than actually shooting.
Now, he goes first to Wichita, and apparently there was a sign over Wichita, everything goes in Wichita?
Well, that could be. That could be. A town like Wichita was, and Dodge City later, the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railroad had come to those towns, and that provided you a rail connection to the stockyards in Chicago, and so cowboys are driving cattle up from Texas. And there are competing towns, and these towns want to get the cowboy trade. And you do that not only by offering the best price for the beef, but also having the most interesting saloons and brothels and gambling tables. And you want that business as well. And that's actually another way to siphon off the cowboy's pay.
And he carried a buntline special?
No, he did not.
Okay, go ahead.
No, he did not. The buntline,
I've seen too many movies.
You have seen, yes. You clearly have seen a lot of these movies.
I have.
The buntline special is this mythical pistol with a 12-inch long barrel that did not exist. The Colt Company did not make it until the 1890s, and it only started being called the Buntline Special in the 1950s. That's when the Hugh O'Brien ABC program, The Life and Legend of Wyatt Earp, was running, and Stuart Lake, who was Wyatt Earp's first biographer and actually interviewed Earp in the last year of his life for that biography, was one of the creators of that program, and he created the Buntline Special idea.
So do we know what Wyatt Earp or even others, what they carried at that time? Or do we know?
We can assume they're carrying the standard pistols at the time, either the Colt or the Navy Colt, perhaps. It's hard to say.
We were talking about this before going on the air, but it's clear that Wyatt Earp is an example of something that seems to be very American. Even, I think you said, even a sort of Don Draper view of Wyatt Earp. This idea that you can invent and reinvent yourself. And I guess the fact that he was moving from town to town, it was possible to start over.
Yes. I mean, this is what is most intriguing to me about Wyatt Earp, that we think of him as this classic American character, as a guy who was going to enforce the law, even if it meant breaking the law. And that's very attractive to a lot of people, a guy who will stand up and fight with his brothers, as that's the O.K. Corral shootout is just held up as this moment of, you know, you're going to show whether you're courageous or not. And to me, what's most important about Wyatt Earp is another kind of American story, and that's the way in which Americans strive to reinvent themselves. And Wyatt Earp in the 1870s and the early 1880s lived in what one historian has called a nation of island communities, that you could pick up and you could go to a new town and nobody'd heard of you. So he could get arrested for horse theft in the Indian Territory and arrested for consorting with prostitutes in Illinois, pick up, move to Wichita, Kansas, and become a police officer because there was no connection here. And Earp thrived in this kind of environment. The problem for him came, and, you know, as I said, he made his living as a gambler. After Tombstone, he became deeply involved in horse racing and as a boxing promoter, two sports which were the two most popular sports in America in the 19th century, also sports with which gamblers had a long association and which are open to being fixed. He was a referee for a heavyweight championship prize fight in 1896, the outcome of which was clearly fixed. I think it was fixed. Everyone at the time thought it was fixed. And that's why he had this extraordinary negative celebrity. And the problem for him was that by the end of the 19th century, that nation of island communities had gone away. Now there is a national media culture. And Wyatt Earp can no longer move to a new town and present himself the way he wants to be presented. He tried. He went all the way to Alaska and ran a saloon there, but he couldn't get away from the celebrity. So it's only in the beginning of the 20th century that he decides, after resenting this negative celebrity for so long, that he would turn this national media culture to his own purposes and present himself the way he wanted to be.
Well, in fact, you say that he took things that his brothers did and made them his own.
Yes. He really admired his older brother, Virgil, which was not unusual for somebody of Wyatt Earp's generation who had been just slightly too young to serve in the Civil War. People in that generation looked up to their older brothers who had served. But he appropriated some of, in his own biography, some of the things that, in fact, Virgil had done.
Let me reintroduce you, and we are talking about Wyatt Earp, believe it or not, and our guest is Andrew Eisenberg. He's a professor of history at Temple University, author of a new book called Wyatt Earp, and it's subtitled A Vigilante Life, and we've been playing some clips from some of the old Hollywood movies of Wyatt Earp, and our guest is telling us that they are largely incorrect, and we are taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. But would it be fair to say that the Earp brothers were close? I mean, it seems that they worked together. They lived in close proximity to themselves. There seemed to be a very powerful bond between these brothers.
Absolutely. And that's one part of that kind of 19th century rural upbringing that stayed with them, that kin would cooperate in all kinds of things. And so the brothers would reassemble. They would move around, but they would reassemble in different towns. They came together in Illinois. They came together in Wichita. They came together in Tombstone.
What brought them to Tombstone? And, of course, this is the, you know, the site for the famous shootout.
Yes, exactly. Well, there was a silver strike in Tombstone, and it was at that moment the newest, biggest mining community. And so 8,000, 9,000, 10,000 people poured into the town in a very short, I mean, there was no town. They created the town in a very short amount of time. There was a lot of money to be made. It wasn't prospectors. It was mining companies employing wage laborers. But there's other money to be made in ancillary ways, serving those kinds of miners. And these are the kinds of communities that Wyatt Earp had been living in for the past seven or 8 years. And so he's very drawn to this. This is where someone who deals faro can find a lot of work. Someone who, in addition to being a faro dealer, will serve as a deputy lawman. Again, he can find a lot of work doing that, he and his brothers.
So he was more interested in playing faro than in silver mining?
Well, this is where the story gets very interesting, because he's got one way of telling his story, and then there's what he did. He went there and was dealing faro. That it's very clear that from the beginning he started doing that, and he was with a fraternity of gamblers who controlled one of the top saloons there. In his various versions of his memoirs, he talks about entering Tombstone already wearing a badge, either the badge of a deputy United States Marshal, which is in fact what his brother Virgil was doing, or a deputy county sheriff, which a badge he later wore, but not at that time. He was at that point trying to construct a story about himself as a man who was primarily a lawman. And that's that's where fact and his own reinvention start departing from each other.
But there were problems with the cowboys, yes? I mean,
absolutely.
Raiding and all that.
This is right along the Mexican border. There's a market for beef, let's put it that way. And not necessarily enough beef at the right price on the American side of the border. Some of these cowboys start moving south, raiding into Mexico, driving it back up. That creates kind of climate of lawlessness. And some of the most lawless of the cowboys start robbing stagecoaches as they're leaving Tombstone carrying silver. And Wyatt Earp becomes involved in trying to track down one group of stage robbers who had in fact killed a couple people. And he wants to do this because he would dearly love to be elected sheriff of the county, because the county sheriff collects taxes and is able to keep a proportion of them. And Cochise County was extraordinarily rich. The biggest landholder was the Southern Pacific Railroad. The proportion of the taxes that the sheriff would be able to keep would amount to, in a year, maybe $30,000, which was an enormous amount. So he desperately desires to hold this position. And he thinks if he can catch these stage robbers, that will ensure his election. He schemes with some cowboys to lure those robbers to a ranch. That scheme breaks down. And when that scheme breaks down, that sets in motion the gunfight that happens in October 1881.
But you're saying that he was more interested in making money as a lawman than actually
the
truth, justice, and the American way?
The Earp family had long served either as constables or justices of the peace. And This is what Max Weber called booty politics. You can make money per arrest or in terms of court fees. And so the ERPs would arrest people, bring them in. They'd get a payment for the arrest. They'd get a payment for the court fees. In Monmouth, some of ERP's relatives, Monmouth, Illinois, where he was born, they had a scheme where they would buy up bad debt, bring the debtor before the Justice of the Peace. The Justice of the Peace, who is an ERP, would order the person to pay the debt back to another ERP, and then they'd get the court costs paid to them as well. And so they'd seen local office in this kind of way for a long time. So, and they're not alone in seeing
it this
way.
Well, I was just going to ask you whether you, I mean, maybe what was unusual is we had a family here, the ERPs.
Let's put it this way. For Tombstone in the 1880s or southern Arizona in the 1880s, what's going on is that everybody is engaged in a scramble for wealth. And both in terms of public office and unfenced cattle and public land and minerals that are beneath the surface of public land, everybody is blurring the line between public and private. And in fact, the political economy at the time encourages them to blur that line. And in terms of the violence that happens, the ERP's role as public officers, that got blurred with a kind of private feud. But again, that blurring of public and private is not unusual.
And I do want to talk about what happened at the OK Corral. We're talking about, 30 seconds in history?
Yes, 30 seconds. Not in the OK Corral, but in the empty lot behind it. His brother is the town marshal. Virgil is the town marshal, and he deputizes Wyatt Earp and his brother Morgan. And he didn't formally deputize Doc Holliday, but there was no real formal process of deputizing somebody. If you're helping the town marshal, you're his deputy. That's what everyone assumes. The men with whom Earp had worked to try and lure these stage robbers to justice were now afraid that their complicity was going to be revealed, and so they started issuing public threats to the Earps to try to insulate themselves from the belief that they were actually complicit with the town marshal or his brother. And so the Earps went down there simply to confiscate the weapons that they were carrying within the town limits, which was against the law,
right.
And the shooting broke out. Did they walk down there thinking there'd be a gunfight? Hard to say. Did they walk down there and shoot first? Well, that's the really uncharitable way of looking at it. Did they shoot only when the cowboys fired on them?
We don't know.
There are lots of different accounts in terms of what happened.
And I'm assuming there are perhaps news accounts there or diaries or...
You know, everybody in the town was a partisan, either of the ERPs or the cowboys. And so finding a kind of... accounts that seem objective is really quite difficult.
Well, we're going to take another short break and then get back to our conversation. We are talking with Andrew Eisenberg about his new book. It's called Wyatt Earp, A Vigilante Life. And we've been playing some clips from some of the Hollywood versions of the story of Wyatt Earp. And we're also taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Any questions or comments or corrections about Wyatt Earp, give us a call. That phone number again, 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Delaware Art Museum in Wilmington supports WHYY and presents French Twist, masterworks of photography from Atjeh to Man Ray, on view through September 15th. Featuring vintage black and white prints from the golden age of French photography, this exhibition includes pioneering photojournalism, lyrical views of Paris streets and gardens, notorious creatures of the night, and surrealist experiments. For more information, 302-571-9590 or delart.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Dustin Hoffman. He made his directorial debut with the film Quartet, which is now out on DVD. Hoffman's been praised for breaking the mold of the movie star as handsome leading man. But when he starred in The Graduate, people said to director Mike Nichols,
"What a great film you would have had if you had not miscast the lead."
Dustin Hoffman on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm John Hockenberry of The Takeaway. The Takeaway is a fast-paced look at the news of the day. It's in-the-moment conversations that take the facts and frame them in ways that make you think. Newsmakers, experts, and people affected by the news, all part of the conversation. The talk is better when there's more at stake. So listen to The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, again talking with Andrew Eisenberg about his new book called Wyatt Earp, A Vigilante Life. And let me play a clip from another Wyatt Earp film. This one starring Kevin Costner and also stars Dennis Quaid as Doc Holliday. Let's listen to this.
Tell me about the reward, Wyatt Earp.
You'd be doing me a favor if you would call me either Wyatt or Earp. Not both.
All right. Wyatt. Call me Doc.
I'm looking at your face. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I have to have a least favorite Wyatt Earp film.
You're allowed.
And the Kevin Costner Wyatt Earp film is my least favorite for a lot of... Well, it's... first of all, I'll say at the top that Costner did a miniseries on the History Channel just recently, which was about the feud in Kentucky,
McCoys,
exactly, which was a much better Wyatt Earp film than the Wyatt Earp film he made, because it was much more in the context of how feuds between kin, and they're all trying to kind of grab public office, and they're wearing badges, but they're also enforcing, you know, sort of private grudges. That's much more what might have been really going on in Tombstone. What this film does is it overlays Shakespeare's Henry IV and Henry V onto Wyatt Earp, that it makes Wyatt Earp this flawed Prince Hal in the beginning, who's leading this very wayward life, and then he becomes this man of justice toward the end. The thing about Wyatt Earp that I discovered in the course of my search is that he never really repented of his misspent youth. He just kept going on.
Reinventing it or just starting over?
He kept reinventing, and he kept being drawn into petty crime. As late as 1911, he's arrested by the Los Angeles Bunco Squad for running a crooked faro game. He's not someone who had some kind of moment of epiphany and gave up on that earlier life of crime and then became a lawman completely. That just never happened.
Who, in your movie version of Wyatt Earp, who would play Wyatt Earp? Have you thought about that?
I've actually been asked. There's a blog that asks authors to do just that. It's called My Book, The Movie, and I had a post on there
recently.
Oh,
I love that idea of that blog.
You mentioned Don Draper earlier, and John Hamm is somebody who would have the physical presence to play Earp, but also can play that kind of person who's reinvented himself over and over. So, type of person.
And how about Doc Holliday? Have you gotten that far?
Walton Goggins.
Oh, excellent.
Walton Goggins.
I would watch that show.
I think that'd work well.
So after the shootout at the OK Corral, what happens to Tombstone? I mean, what happens to this? Is this a tiny little incident in the sweep of history?
See, what's most interesting about the violence in Tombstone is not necessarily that gunfight in October 1881. After that gunfight... Virgil Earp and Morgan Earp are wounded.
Yes.
Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday are conveyed to a courtroom, and they endure a month-long courtroom ordeal. It was a coroner's inquest, but essentially was treated as a trial by everybody. And for part of that time, Earp and Holliday are in jail. And they eventually there are no charges. It's not going to go to a trial. But the cowboys who've seen three of their number killed in the shootout are just not willing to accept that result. They shotgun Virgil, and he loses use of one of his arms in December 1881, and then in March 1882, they assassinate Morgan Earp. And that's when Wyatt Earp, again, as he did after his wife died, he kind of snaps, and in a period of a couple weeks, he goes out with some of his friends, including Doc Holliday and some other men who are heavily armed, and they kill at least two men, maybe a third. And these are men they held responsible for the murder of Morgan.
And were they wearing – I mean, Because he's played both sides of the law, was he a lawman at the time or not?
He was wearing the badge of a deputy United States Marshal at the time, which ironically is the same kind of officer who had arrested him in Indian Territory for horse theft. But there's no effort to bring these men into a courtroom. If you look at the coroner's accounts, all these men are shot multiple times, and more than one of these wounds could have been fatal. And in one case, the man who was killed, he had not fired his own pistol.
So revenge, I mean, rather
than
justice?
Summary executions, and I think they were revenge. And it's only later on that Earp starts casting this as this was the way you had to enforce justice in this time. And he only comes to that conclusion after his brother-in-law gives him a copy of Owen Wister's novel, 1901 novel, The Virginian, which has an account in it of vigilante justice, where the main character, the Virginian, has to hang a cattle thief who had been one of his friends. And he does this reluctantly. He does this because, you know, this is just a man doing his duty. And it was only at that point that Earp starts talking about his foray into vigilantism in that kind of way. So he really models the violence that he was engaged in on the Virginian in a lot of ways.
He ends up living with, marrying, right, Josephine Marcus. This is this person who he spent, 30, 40 years together, towards the end of his life. And that only underscores how, young he was when all this was going on, probably in his 30s.
He was in his 30s when he was in Tombstone.
Right. Yeah. And I realize 30s today is not like 30s back 100 years ago, but still seems like a young man.
Yes.
In his career.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But he lives on. I mean, he doesn't die until 1929. So he lived long enough to see a lot of the modern world.
Yeah. And he was never shot, right? Never wounded? Or do we know that?
No.
We don't know that?
Well, he was never shot. That's part of the lore of Earp.
He, as you said, for a time goes to Alaska, looking for the kind of riches you could find in Alaska.
Well, he doesn't ever dig for gold. He runs a saloon. Right? This is what he'd become very good at. After Tombstone, he goes to a couple mining camps in Colorado and one in Idaho. And then later on, there's this trip up to Alaska. And then after that, several silver mines in Nevada. And in all of them, he's running a saloon. He's dealing cards. That's the world that he inhabited for most of his life.
And why do you think he wanted to create this image of himself? I mean, obviously, it mattered to him, and it looks like he had a reputation at stake.
He makes a miscalculation in the 1890s. He spent the late 1880s and the early 1890s living in California. He's a boxing promoter, and he's training horses. He's run into a lot of debts, and so he angles to get himself to be the referee of this heavyweight prize fight. It seems like it's fixed. It's the biggest sports scandal until the 1919 Black Sox World Series gambling scandal.
And he's the referee.
He's the referee. And right. What he does is there's a favorite, there's an underdog. The favorite in the eighth round knocks out the underdog, but the blow before the knockout punch had been a body blow. And Earp says the blow was below the belt, and he awards the heavyweight championship to the underdog who's being carried out of the ring at the time. And everybody in the arena is crying, it didn't happen that way. But he's the referee, he made his decision, and then he quickly leaves the arena.
You describe a number of, biographers who at least attempt to write about him and sort of come to a dead end or just it doesn't work out
right.
in his lifetime.
Well, when Earp then goes to Hollywood and he's trying to remake his reputation, he first dictates his memoirs to a woman, Forestine Hooker, who mm-hmm. writes magazine stories and children's stories. And she'd been... she was the daughter-in-law of someone who had lived in Tombstone or near Tombstone and knew Earp. But he doesn't like that account. It ends up casting him not as a man who is seeking justice, but just as a man who is seeking vengeance. And so he dictates the account, she writes it up, and then he puts it in a desk drawer and won't allow it to be published. And he goes to a young friend of his, and he dictates his memoirs again, and that's the version he likes. But this young friend is such a horrible writer that it's rejected by every publishing house. And then only in the last couple of years of his life does Stuart Lake, who is his eventual biographer, write to him, ask if anyone's writing your biography, I would like to do it. And it's at that, it's just at the moment when this other account has been rejected. And so he turns to Lake, and Lake interviews him briefly and then puts together a lot of the stories that we know about Wyatt.
And Hollywood falls in love with these stories, yes?
Absolutely. But, you know, the point is that Earp had been hanging out in Hollywood for so long, he'd already been guiding his accounts of his life toward a kind of Hollywood version, a version that Hollywood would find so acceptable. And Lake, who was an aspiring screenwriter, understood this perfectly. And so the two of them were kind of a nice partnership in this regard.
And why do you think this has endured? I mean, the Kevin Costner movie actually is about 20 years old, but I think it's played a lot on TV and it's, you know, has a very compelling narrative.
Well, I think there's a very simple reason why this has endured, and that is that Earp has become a symbol of extra-legal justice. He is the symbol for people who say, you're not going to find justice in courtrooms. Courtrooms are fickle or they're corrupt. The only way you're going to get justice is by enforcing it on your own. So when Earp has his vigilante ride and goes out and kills these men, that's the thing that people seize on, right? And so that's the way Stuart Lake wrote it up in the 1930s. He cast Wyatt Earp as a kind of Elliot Ness of the Old West. And in his research notes, he has the cowboys. The leader of them is kind of an Al Capone who's running this huge criminal organization across the entire Southwest. And Wyatt Earp, in the Burt Lancaster film that you played a piece of, that during the Cold War, the lawman is this kind of Cold War figure. And again, you have to go outside the law because your enemies are so bad. If you try to stick to the law, you'll be defeated. And he's been invoked in recent years in some political quarters in the same way.
And what does it take to detangle this story then, which is sort of what you
This is essentially what I'm engaged in here. I think what we need to remember is that Earp was not a guy who had this abiding belief in justice, that he was a guy who had been on both sides of the law. And so when he took law into his own hands as a vigilante, this was not the act of a man who, except for that one instance, had always been on the side of the law. Instead, it's the act of a man who'd been on both sides of the law for most of his life, who'd been a kind of card sheet. We haven't talked about him as a con man, but faro dealers and the con men, there was a blurry line between them, and he sometimes sold rocks painted yellow as gold bricks. So he was a guy who'd made up the rules for himself for a long time.
And do you think there's still, and perhaps because I'm a kid of the 50s and 60s, I mean, there was something, we used to play cowboys and Indians. I mean, there was something about the West then. I don't know if it has that same kind of lure today, but do you think there's still something about the West that speaks to some of these issues we've been talking about?
I think that there is. I think that there remains a lot of interest in Wyatt Earp, and there is a lot of interest in this image. There are clearly a lot of people who are deeply invested in that image of the man who embodies in himself justice, that justice is not some abstract principle that you arrive at in a courtroom, but it's to borrow the words of Wayne LaPierre, it's a good guy with a gun. And Wyatt Earp is the classic good guy with a gun. At least in the mythic sense.
In the mythic sense of what that means. I don't know how old you are. Did you watch the TV show, The Life and Legend of Wyatt Earp?
I only saw the TV show when I started on this project. I mean, it was in reruns when I was young, but I'd never come across it until I sort of started doing research for this book.
So how would you critique The Life and Legend of Wyatt Earp? And this starred, who starred as Wyatt Earp?
Hugh O'Brien.
Hugh O'Brien, of course.
Hugh O'Brien.
Of course.
Stuart Lake was one of the creators of the show, and he had a hand in sort of guiding it. So in many ways, it adheres to his version of Earp's life as, you know, more closely than any of the films.
We're almost out of time here. Have you gotten any pushback from your book?
Sure. Sure. Like I said, there are a lot of people
who are
deeply invested in the idea of Earp as this symbol of rectitude and as a kind of masculine symbol as well. And you know, he was more complex than that Hollywood image would have you believe. And particularly, you know, there are some biographies of him that focus almost entirely on that two-year period that he lived in Tombstone. But if you look at the big sweep of his life and the trouble he ran into as a young man, as an older man, I think you get a very different and more contextualized and more complex idea of who he really was.
Well, Andrew Eisenberg, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times. The book is Wyatt Earp, A Vigilante Life. We want to close things out with the theme from the life and legend of Wyatt Earp, written by Harry Warren and Harold Adamson, performed by the Ken Darby Singers.
Wyatt Earp, Wyatt Earp, brave, courageous, and bold. Long live his fame, and long live his glory, and long may his story be told. The country, the old Wild West country, he made law and order prevail. And none can deny it, the legend of Wyatt forever will live on the trail.
Oh, Wyatt Earp, Wyatt Earp, brave, courageous, and bold. Long live his fame, and long live his glory, and long may his story be told. Wyatt Earp, Wyatt Earp, brave, courageous, and bold. Long live his fame, and long live his glory, and long may his story be told.